The dust met on the uni of life high. Brush deep talks to the dude with the slide by. The view on the wide open. It's 10 a.m. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO in Portland, Oregon, USA, and online at kboo.fm. I'm your regular host, Andrew Geller, and today we're going to do a bunch of follow-up on previous shows and share some new news with you on topics we haven't quite covered but are near and dear to my interest. So the second half of the show will be climate-oriented, and the first half will feature non-climate stuff, I guess. I will post all these articles, links to all these full articles on the People Rise Up website, as well as links to articles that I am not going to feature, but read with the question in mind of whether or not to feature them. This here, first off, going to start with an article written by Jason Leopold, an investigative reporter writing for Truth Out. He's been doing a lot of follow-up on the National Security Agency spy scandal, but it's way bigger than the National Security Agency, and it's way more than Bush making his authorization in 2002. In the months before 9/11, thousands of American citizens were inadvertently swept up in wiretaps, had their emails monitored, and were being watched as they surfed the internet by spies at the super-secret National Security Agency, former NSA and counterterrorism officials said. The NSA, with full knowledge of the White House, crossed the line from routine surveillance of foreigners and suspected terrorists into illegal activity by continuing to monitor the international telephone calls and emails of Americans without a court order. The NSA unintentionally intercepts Americans' phone calls and emails if the agency's computers zero in on a specific keyword used in the communication. But once the NSA figures out that they are listening in on an American, the eavesdropping is supposed to immediately end and the identity of the individual is supposed to be deleted. While the agency did follow protocol, there were instances when the NSA was instructed to keep tabs on certain individuals that became of interest to some White House officials. What sets this type of operation apart from the unprecedented covert domestic spying activities the NSA had been conducting after 9/11 is a top secret executive order signed by George W. Bush in 2002, authorizing the NSA to target specific American citizens. Prior to 9/11, American citizens were the subject of nonspecific surveillance by the NSA that was condoned and approved by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, according to former NSA and counterterrorism officials. The former officials said that even during the Clinton administration, the NSA would inadvertently obtain the identities of American citizens in its wiretaps as a result of certain keywords like bomb or jihad. By law, the NSA is prohibited from spying on a United States citizen, a U.S. corporation, or an immigrant who is in this country on permanent residence. With permission from a special court, the NSA can eavesdrop on diplomats and foreigners inside the U.S. After Bush assumed office in 2001, the way the NSA normally handled those issues started to change dramatically. In the summer of 2001, Dick Cheney was tapped by Bush to be more of a presence at intelligence agencies, including the CIA and NSA. It was then that the NSA started receiving numerous requests from Cheney and other officials in the State and Defense Departments to reveal the identities of Americans blacked out or deleted from intelligence reports so administration officials could better understand the context of the intelligence. Separately at this time, Cheney was working with intelligence agencies, including the NSA, to develop a large-scale emergency plan to deal with biological, chemical, or nuclear attack on U.S. soil. Requesting that the NSA reveal the identity of Americans caught in wiretaps is legal as long as it serves the purpose of understanding the context of the intelligence information. But the sources said that on dozens of occasions, Cheney would, upon learning the identity of the individual, instruct the NSA to continue monitoring specific Americans caught in the wiretaps if he thought more information would be revealed. This crossed the line into illegal territory. Cheney advised Bush of what had turned up in the raw NSA reports, said one former White House official who worked on counterterrorism issues. The official said, quote, "What's really disturbing is that some of those people the vice president was curious about were people who worked at the White House or the State Department. There was a real feeling of paranoia that permeated from the vice president's office, and I don't think it had to do with the threat of terrorism." So that's from an article, NSA Spying Evolved Pre-9/11 by Jason Leopold from Truth Out. There is much more to it there. Okay, so last week, many of us listened to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. This is, and we'll touch on this article's content a whole lot more next week, actually. This is from Arizona Central. During Senate Judiciary Committee hearings last Thursday, Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito stated that a president has the constitutional authority on very rare occasions to violate federal law. Citing Bush's claim that the Constitution hands a president wide leeway to protect the country in time of war, Alito said, quote, "I think it follows from the structure of our Constitution that the Constitution trumps a statute." Alito then added, quote, "It would be a rare instance in which it would be justifiable for the president or any member of the executive branch not to abide by a statute passed by Congress." The statute in question is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which grants presidents emergency authority to spy on suspects for up to 72 hours before obtaining a court order. After 72 hours, a court order must be sought, and if not granted, surveillance must be stopped. Violating this is a felony subject to imprisonment and fines. California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein asked Samuel Alito, quote, "If Congress has explicit authority under the Constitution to pass a law, and we pass a law, is the president bound by that law, or does his plenary authority supersede that Constitution?" Samuel Alito said, "The president, like everybody else, is bound by statutes that are enacted by Congress." However, Alito added that the president could violate a statute, quote, "if statutes are unconstitutional because the Constitution takes precedence over a statute." And I'll leave the text there to note that the judiciary branch is the one that declares statutes constitutional or not. The president has no authority to deem something passed by Congress constitutional or not, although George W. Bush apparently thinks that he does. In other Supreme Court-related news, this from OneWorld.net, U.S. coverage. In a case involving a private citizen and Michigan police authorities, civil rights lawyers appeared before the Supreme Court last week to challenge the police practice of storming into homes to look for whatever they want as evidence of a crime. The case was brought by Booker Hudson, a resident of Detroit, who says he was arrested by several police officers after they broke into his home without warning. Hudson was found guilty of possession of a small quantity of cocaine that was found in the pocket of his pants. He was sentenced by a local judge to 18 months of probation. Hudson challenged the verdict all the way to the Michigan State Supreme Court, arguing that the evidence used against him was found in violation of his constitutional rights. The Michigan State Supreme Court rejected his plea last January. Hudson's lawyers argued that police had no right to enter his home without knocking at the door and announcing their presence, as required by the U.S. Constitution's Fourth Amendment. Lawyers representing Hudson say they are hopeful that the Supreme Court will decide the case in their favor by ordering the suppression of evidence against their client. The Supreme Court is expected to make its judgment on Hudson's case in June. Now, just for clarification, that case is going to decide at the level of the U.S. Supreme Court whether or not law enforcement can walk into your house unannounced. Yes, I understand the Patriot Act allows sneak and peek searches. Typically, those are done when people are not there. I don't know if the semantics are important on that. But continuing on with the fascism series that People Rise Up is doing this year, we will have a lot more regarding police power here in the United States. Let me see here. This is from the New Zealand Herald yesterday. China's foreign exchange reserves rose to a record last year, almost matching Japan's as the world's largest, as a swelling trade surplus and money inflows betting on a currency reevaluation boosted holdings. The People's Bank of China said reserves rose to $819 billion U.S. dollars at the end of December, from $770 billion at the end of September and $610 billion from a year before. Japan's foreign exchange reserves stood at $824 billion at the end of November. China has been investing its reserves in U.S. government debt and held $247 billion U.S. dollars in treasury bonds at the end of October, making it the largest investor in the United States after Japan. The bank said the government was looking for new ways to invest the money to seek higher returns. Julian Jessop, chief international economist at Capital Economics in London, said, quote, "The bigger the reserves get, the more nervous China is likely to be about keeping them predominantly in U.S. dollars." He continued, quote, "China's probably not going to do a lot with its existing reserves, but what it might do is put a smaller portion of its new reserves into U.S. dollars." The nation's reserves of foreign currency, which economists estimate are between 70 to 80% in U.S. dollars, have almost tripled since the end of 2002. In a report to its governments, the European Commission said that China might invest more of its reserves in other currencies, putting downward pressure on the U.S. dollar. Even so, Stephen Green and Tai Hui of the Standard Chartered Bank said China's reserves might rise by another 20% to $1 trillion U.S. dollars by the end of the year, the first time any nation's reserves have reached that level. little John Coltrane there from the Village Vanguard. Those are the master tapes. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. We're doing a news wrap today, and we're now going to jump towards the climate change part of the program. A lot has happened in the world of climate change research, as it always is, since we last covered this topic in late November, when the COP10 conference was going on. So, let's see here. Okay, this is from a couple days ago. The Independent out of London. Preliminary figures show that levels of carbon dioxide, the main cause of human-induced climate change, have risen abruptly in the past 4 years, causing scientists to fear that the warming is entering a new phase and may accelerate further. Through most of the past half century, levels of the gas rose by an annual average of 1.3 parts per million. In the late 90s, this figure rose to 1.6 parts per million per year, and in 2002 and 2003, the recorded annual increase was 2 parts per million. Unpublished figures for the first 10 months of 2005 show a rise of 2.2 parts per million. Scientists believe this may be the first evidence that climate change is now self-reproducing, as higher temperatures alter natural systems and the Earth itself releasing more gas, driving the thermostat ever higher. Now, just for reference, I want people to know that I'm going to do a little comparison here. In the annual rate of CO2 concentration increase, these are all parts per million. If we use 1.3 parts per million as a baseline from the 50s through the early 90s, in the late 90s, that increased 23% annually, up to 1.6. Compared to the original 1.3, 2002 and 2003 figures of 2.0 parts per million per year were 154% of the background baseline. And the preliminary 2005 figures are 170% of the annual increase in CO2 atmospheric concentration compared to just 20 years ago. Edward Brooke works in the Department of Geosciences down at Oregon State University, had a paper published at the end of November in Science magazine entitled "Tiny Bubbles Tell All," in which he reports that new ice core records coming from the European Project for Ice Coring in Antarctica, or EPICA, concentrations of CO2 in ice core samples show that the level of atmospheric carbon is currently higher than at any point in the past 650,000 years. And I'm not going to go into a lot of the detail on that. It's a great article to check out. Let's see. This here from about a week and a half ago, news release from the National Science Foundation. Newly published research results provide evidence that global climate change may have quickly disrupted ocean processes and led to drastic shifts in environments around the world. Although the events described unfolded millions of years ago and spanned thousands of years, the researchers say they provide one of the few historical analogs for warming-induced changes in the large-scale sea circulation and may help to illuminate potential long-term impacts of today's climate warming. Writing in the journal Nature, scientists Flavia Nunez and Richard Norris explained that they probed a 4 to 7 degree warming that occurred 55 million years ago during the closing stages of the Paleocene and at the beginning of the Eocene eras. The unique data set they constructed, based on the chemical makeup of tiny ancient sea creatures, uncovered for the first time evidence of a monumental reversal in the circulation of deep ocean patterns around the world. Researchers concluded it was triggered by the global warming the world was then experiencing. The results indicate that deep ocean circulation in the southern hemisphere abruptly stopped the conveyor belt-like process known as overturning, in which cold and salty water in the depths exchange with warm water on the surface. Researchers believe this shift drove unusually warm water into the deep sea, likely releasing stores of methane gas that drove unusually warm, that led to further global warming and a massive die-off in deep sea marine life. Science Daily reports a few days ago that an international research team has proven for the first time that global warming is behind an infectious disease epidemic that is wiping out entire frog populations and forcing many other amphibious species to extinction. Researchers say that 67% of the 110 species of the harlequin frog, which only exists in the American tropics, have met the same extinction fate due to a pathogenic fungus called Botrachochytrium dendrobetitis. The researchers discovered that between 1975 and 2000, air temperature for the tropics increased by 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade, triple the average rate of warming for the entire 20th century. The paper states this warming has reduced mist frequency at Monte Verde Cloud Forest Research Station by raising the heights of cloud formation, which may promote the survival, growth, and reproduction of the fungi. The study comes at a time of growing concern about the future of amphibians. The Global Amphibian Assessment, published in 2004, found that nearly one-third of the world's 6,000 or so identified species of frogs, toads, and salamanders are threatened with extinction, a figure far greater than that for any other group of animals. Going to do a, or attempt to do a very quick synopsis here of dozens of pages of data from the National Climate Data Center. We've historically had Jay Lorimore, scientist with the National Climate Data Center, on in late January to discuss year-end weather data. We're going to skip that this year. I'm going to do a summary here and try and squeeze in some information from Gaia Theory founder, scientist James Lovelock. Okay, so first, summarizing 2005 from the National Climate Data Center. This is data published January 13. New analysis shows that 2005 global average temperatures are 0.61 degrees Celsius or 1.1 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term average, making 2005 the warmest year on record, topping 1998's previous record of 1.04 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term average. During the past century, global surface temperatures have increased at a rate of roughly 1.1 degrees Fahrenheit per century. However, as previously noted on this program repeatedly, this trend has increased to a rate of 3.2 degrees Fahrenheit per century in the past 30 years. The largest anomalies were widespread throughout high-latitude regions of the Northern Hemisphere, including much of Russia, Scandinavia, Canada, and Alaska. Temperatures in these regions were between 5 and 9 degrees Fahrenheit above the 1961 to 1990 average. There were no widespread areas of negative anomalies. I think we'll skip temperature extreme information, only to note that in Death Valley, California, for 7 consecutive days in mid-July, temperatures topped 125 degrees. That's a new record for Death Valley. Regarding sea ice extent in the Northern Hemisphere, September 2005, and these figures are always calculated in September, which is the lowest sea ice extent total historically, so September is the baseline month. 2005, September, the all-time lowest sea ice extent on the historical record happened just 3, 4, 5 months ago. Mean Northern Hemisphere snow cover extent during the winter, December, January, February, was slightly above average, but that was due to anomalously cold and snowy conditions across Europe. Snow cover for the winter across North America was below average, and it was significantly below average in the spring season. Spring snow cover extent in the Northern Hemisphere has been below average for 15 of the last 18 years. In 2005, we had the lowest seasonal snow cover extent in the spring since 1968. There's more about seasonal analysis globally for the U.S. statewide, as well as precipitation statewide and the Atlantic hurricane season, which, again, set a record. All of that's available at the National Climate Data Center, and the People Rise Up website will have links to it. Sorry to be hurrying along right here, but I want to get to some of this piece related to James Lovelock, founder of the Gaia Theory, which basically states that the Earth is a living organism that has a planetary-scale control system keeping the environment fit for life of all forms. Writing in The Independent 2 days ago, Monday the 16th, James Lovelock writes, "Each nation must find the best use of its resources to sustain civilization for as long as they can. This article is the most difficult I have written. My Gaia theory sees the Earth behaving as if it were alive, and clearly anything alive can enjoy good health or suffer disease. The climate centers around the world, which are the equivalent of the pathology lab of a hospital, have reported the Earth's physical condition, and the climate specialists see it as seriously ill, soon to pass into a morbid fever that may last as long as 100,000 years. I have to tell you, as members of the Earth's family and an intimate part of it, that you, and especially civilization, are in grave danger. Our planet has kept itself healthy and fit for life just as an animal and a plant does, for most of the more than 3 billion years of its existence. We have given Gaia a fever, and soon her condition will worsen to a state like a coma. She has been there before and recovered, but it took more than 100,000 years. Now, we are responsible, and we will suffer the consequences as this century progresses. The temperature may rise 8 degrees centigrade in temperate regions, 5 degrees in the tropics." Breaking from the text, Portland, Oregon is in the temperate region. 8 degrees Celsius is 14.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Back to the text. "Curiously, aerosol pollution of the Northern Hemisphere reduces global warming by reflecting sunlight back to space, so-called global dimming. It is transient and could disappear in a few days like the smoke that it is, leaving the planet fully exposed to the full heat of the global greenhouse. We are in a fool's climate, accidentally kept cool by smoke, and before this century is over, billions of us will die, and the few breeding pairs of people that survive will be in the Arctic, where the climate remains tolerable." And, okay, a little bit at the end here. So what should we do? First, we have to keep in mind the awesome pace of change and realize how little time is left to act, and that each community and nation must find the best use of the resources they have to sustain civilization for as long as they can. Civilization is energy intensive, and we cannot turn it off without crashing. So we need the security of a powered descent. At that point, I'm just going to say that's what I've got time for here. Links to all the articles I've referenced here, as well as many others I don't have an opportunity to incorporate, will be featured as hyperlinks at the People Rise Up website, kboo.fm/programs/4.php, or you can just go to the program schedule at kboo.fm and click through to People Rise Up Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. Questions or comments are always welcome. kboo@riseup.net is my email address. And do tune in next week. We'll have a special hour-long program regarding the unilateral executive theory of government as well as impeachment. Coming up just now, Per Fagering will be speaking with Richard Heinberg, who's been writing about energy resource issues and the dynamics of cultural change for many years. His latest book is Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. At 10 on Democracy Now!, folks there will be remembering Eugene McCarthy and looking at the life of Hugh Thompson, the former Army helicopter pilot who helped stop the My Lai massacre in 1968. 6 o'clock tonight on Circle A Radio, tune in for an interview with Professor Brian Glick, author of The War at Home, Covert Actions Against U.S. Activists and What We Can Do About It. Thank you very much for listening today, and stay tuned for Richard Heinberg.
Any activity we conduct is torture, and therefore torture is within the law.
Ah, drat. You know what? I missed the Ubu Hour torture show. Boy.
Don't worry, you can hear it again. Friday, January 20th, 10 a.m.
The Ubu Hour will inflict upon you torture.
On Marlena's Electronic Salon.
And twist back on the head with the snap.
The Ubu Hours, the Torturer's Apprentice. Friday, January 20th, 10 a.m.
We do torture to do our job.